Burns saw people with their eyeballs hanging out, ghosts, the whole city destroyed in an instant. I mean, these people literally survived hell, and they turned their experiences, their suffering, into what Wilfred Burchett, the first Western journalist to go into Hiroshima, later described as the most important force for the abolition of nuclear weapons among humanity. And then to say that it could not come at a better time. What most people don't understand is the increasing danger of nuclear war at this point. Not only in Ukraine, also especially as the United States and China confront one another, the reality that among all the nuclear powers, the threshold for nuclear use is decreasing, and all of the nuclear powers are in the process of so-called modernizing their nuclear arsenals. This is a very dangerous moment, and what the Nobel Committee has done has been in a way to answer the Oppenheimer film. We must, as the Hippakusha say, recognize that human beings and nuclear weapons cannot coexist, and we have to work for their abolition.
And very interesting that the head of the group said he compared Gaza today to Japan after the atomic bombing and the threats of Israel to perhaps blow up a nuclear site in Iran. I wanted to go back to 2016 when Democracy Now! Spoke to Setsuko Thurlow, a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. She is a member of Nihon Hidankyo.
I was a 13-year-old grade 8 student at the girls' school, and I was mobilized by the Army, together with a group of about 30 schoolmates, and we were trained to act as a decoding assistants. And that very day, being Monday, we were to start the day's work as a full-fledged decoding assistant. At 8 o'clock, we had the morning assembly, and the Major Yanai gave us a pep talk. And we said, we will do our best for Emperor's sake. And at that moment, I saw the bluish-white flash in the windows. I was on the second floor of the wooden building, which was 1 mile or 1.8 kilometer away from the ground zero. And after seeing the flash, I had a sensation of floating in the air. All the buildings were flattened by the blast and falling. And obviously, the building I was in was falling, and my body was falling together with it. That's the end of my recollection. Then I regained my consciousness, and when I regained, I found myself in a total darkness and the silence. I tried to move my body, but I couldn't, so I knew I was faced with death. I thought, finally, Americans got us. Then I started hearing the whispering voices of my classmates who were around me in the same room. Mother, help me. God, help me. And all of a sudden, strong male voice said, don't give up. I'm trying to free you. Keep moving. Keep pushing. And you see the sunray coming through that opening. Get moving toward that direction. Crawl. And that's what I did in the total darkness. I didn't see anything. But by the time I came out, the building was on fire. That meant all my classmates who were with me, about 30 of them, were burned to death alive. And two other girls managed to come out. Three of us looked around outside. And although it happened in the morning, it was dark, dark as twilight. And as our eyes got used to recognize things, those dark moving objects happened to be human beings. It was like a procession of ghosts. I say ghosts because they simply did not look like human beings. Their hair was rising upwards, and they were covered with blood and dirt, and they were burned and blackened and swollen. Their skin and flesh were hanging, and parts of the bodies were missing. Some were carrying their own eyeballs, and as they collapsed onto the ground, their stomach burst open and the intestines started stretching out.
That was Setsuko Thurlow speaking on Democracy Now! In 2016, a survivor of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima, also a member of Nihon Hidankyo, which just won the Nobel Peace Prize. She's lived in Canada for decades. She is well over 90 years old. Thanks so much to Joseph Gerson, president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, and former vice president of the International Peace Bureau. Coming up, The Apprentice, the movie Trump doesn't want you to see. Stay with us. Tears Are Spilling by the Japanese musician Ryoko Moriyama. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to what Variety magazine has called the most controversial movie of the year, and what Salon calls the movie Trump doesn't want you to see. The Apprentice is a new biopic about Donald Trump's rise to fame in the 80s and his close relationship with Roy Cohn, who served as a chief counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Red Scare of the 1950s. Earlier this year, lawyers for Trump attempted to block screenings of the film, claiming the movie is a, quote, concoction of lies that repeatedly defames President Trump. Despite the threats, the film is opening in New York today. This is a trailer for The Apprentice.
Yes.
Hello, this is Donald Trump from Mr. Cohn. Thank you so much.
Donald who?
1, 2, 3, 4!
Roy Cohn, nice to meet you.
You, Roy Cohn, you're brutal.
Guilty as charged.
I didn't always win.
There's rules. The first rule is attack, attack, attack.
It's gonna be the finest building in the city. Maybe the country. In the world.
Rule 2, admit nothing. Deny everything.
There's never been anything like this, of this magnitude, this quality.
Ooh, cheese balls over here.
What are you doing?
You want one?
No, it looks totally disgusting.
Cheese balls.
Rule 3, no matter what happens, you claim victory and never admit defeat.
You have to be willing to do anything to anyone to win.
You have a big ass. You gotta work on that.
Your face looked like an orange.
Attack, attack, attack. Deny everything, admit nothing. Never admit defeat.
What if you lost your fortune today?
Well, then maybe I'll run for president. I don't know.
I say if you're indicted, you're invited.
The trailer for the new film, The Apprentice, a dramatized portrayal of Donald Trump's close relationship with Roy Cohn in the 1980s. Roy Cohn, chief counsel to McCarthy, also largely responsible for the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in 1953. We're joined now by the award-winning Iranian-Danish filmmaker Ali Abbasi, who directed The Apprentice, which premiered earlier this year at the Cannes Film Festival. His previous films include Holy Spider, set in Tehran, and Border, set in around Stockholm. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to Ali earlier this week and asked him about why he decided to focus on Roy Cohn and Donald Trump in this film.
for me, The Apprentice is not a Trump biopic as such. It's about a, you know, transformative relationship of him and the mentorship of Roy Cohn. It's sort of a buddy movie for two villains, if you like, or two superheroes, or, you know, two anti-heroes, whichever way you want to look at it. And, you know, Roy was a wonderfully colorful character. He was, as you were mentioning, Joseph McCarthy's right-hand man, you know, was sort of a legal wonder kid coming, like, I think it was like 21, 22 when he joined the legal team of Joseph McCarthy, and was very instrumental in sort of persecuting this whole sort of the Red Scare. And after that, actually, you know, he was also involved in Lavender Scare, which was persecuting homosexuals in federal government, himself being a closeted gay man. Anyways, later in '60s, you know, he starts his law practice in New York, but what he really does there, he becomes sort of a fixer and a socialite, where he connects people. He has immense political power. You know, he's good friends with Richard Nixon. You know, he knows a lot of people. He, you know, at some point he's repping all the five mob families in New York at the same time. You know, and Andy Warhol, and people from Studio 54, and celebrities, and politicians, and you name it. And I think that he was also a PR genius. You know, he was extremely good at sort of getting hang of, you know, media. Everyone, all the reporters loved him. You know, he was, you know, very good at getting stuff out there. And he was the person who sort of built Trump, you know, as a person, as a brand, as an identity from ground up, in a way, and you know, taught him to create his own reality when he needed.
I mean, you also said about the film that it's about the American system.
That's
a
right.
System that allowed someone like Roy Cohn to operate in the way that he did. So was there something about the system that you wanted to convey in the film?
Yeah. Look, I'm born and raised in Iran, and as such, I have this sort of outside view of the American politics and justice and legal system. And I think, you know, this system was not created by Donald Trump. It wasn't created even by Roy Cohn. This system is in place, and these people are very good at navigating it. This is a system where, you know, you can, you know, bury people with legal firepower if you have enough money. You can, you know, pull different strings. You can, almost buy votes, you know. At the same time, it is a democracy, but it's a flawed democracy, which makes it, like, full of different loopholes and different, like, backdoors and whatnot. And I think these people were experts in using those loopholes and using those sort of, you know, corners and fringes to get what they want from the system. At the same time, you know, the whole sort of American society as such is based also on this social Darwinism, you know, which is, you know, winner takes it all, and if either you're a killer or you're killed. And that sort of ideological backbone is there. You know, you can see it with Donald, you can see it with Roy, you can see it with Fred Trump, who was Donald's dad. You know, he wanted his sons and, you know, children to become killers, you know.
And speaking of which, in terms of the film, the attempted killing of the film, Cannes Film Festival, 11-minute standing ovation, but also a legal letter from the Trump campaign team. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, we got it didn't take long. And we got this cease and desist letter. And basically what it says is, you know, if you attempt to distribute this rubbish and whatnot and try to interfere in our election with foreign money and, you know, a guy from Iran and, you know, all the sort of... It wasn't really addressed to me or Gabe as much as it was addressed
to
Gabe Sherman, right? It was more, I guess, addressed to his base, you know, in a way. So you know, but the threat is there, and we'll see in a few days what's come out of it.
Let's go to a clip of The Apprentice.
You want to know how to win? I'm going to let you in on a little secret. There's rules. Roy Cohn's three rules of winning.
The first rule is the simplest. Attack, attack, attack.
Civil rights, cats.
I hope the pot you stuff has got real money, because after I get you fired, you're sure going to need it.
Excuse me?
Unless you drop your baseless litigation, I am countersuing the Justice Department for
$100 million, and you are going to rue the day that you ever filed this.
Who is this?
Roy Cohn, calling on behalf of my client, Donald J. Trump.
And this is another clip from The Apprentice in which Trump's being interviewed over the phone as he rides in the back of the car with Roy Cohn, who's advising him what to say.
Listen, Judy, about 100 reporters were crawling up my to get this interview, and I gave you the exclusive.
Yes, hello, Judy. This is Donald Trump. Very excited to talk to you.
Be excited.
Donald, now that the lawsuit is behind you, what do you want to do next?
Well, I intend to acquire the Commodore, and I'm planning on making it the best and the finest building in the city. Maybe the country. In the world, Judy, in the world, it's going to be the finest building in the world. It's going to be a spectacular hotel. Absolutely spectacular. First class. And
that sounds very ambitious. Where do you get the drive? Still so young, Donald.
I got flair and I'm smart, so I think that's going to make me successful. But I also want to stay humble.
Sorry, Judy. Listen, let's do the rest in person and bring a photographer, okay?
Sorry, Roy.
No, I mean, listen, it's your life. You got a ways to go, but you're learning.
So those are clips from your really magnificent film, The Apprentice, which will open Friday here in New York. So, I mean, you know, one of the things that's so interesting and well done in the film is precisely this relationship, the relationship between Roy Cohn and Trump. So if you could say, what most surprised you when you were working with a journalist, Gabriel Sherman, who's written about Trump for decades in writing the screenplay, what most surprised you in what you discovered about Roy Cohn independently and Trump independently, but also about their relationship, which is really what the film tracks from beginning to end?
Look, these people, they've been depicted, you know, many times, you know, Mr. Trump, obviously, in many different, you know, sketches and you know, satire, and, you know, they've been sort of laughed at and villainized and you know, and you have Angels in America, where Roy is a major character. I think what we tried to do here, which would, you know, differently in a way, was to try to focus on their humanity. You know, we try to deal with them as human beings, you know, who have real pain, real feelings, real pleasure, you know. And I think that's where the surprising part is, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, that someone like Roy Cohn, being the person he was, you know, being a pretty malicious political operative, among other things, also could recite, you know, classic Persian poetry, you know, from 1,000 years ago. Also, you know, was generous to his friends and loyal, you know. And same goes with Mr. Trump, you know. But everyone said, okay, you know, when we were doing the movie, that, you know, all my liberal friends was like, you know, we can't believe that he has feelings. We can't believe that he ever get affected. And one of the things I you know, when I was reading about it, you know, the interesting thing is, for example, his relationship with his brother, Freddie, who sort of got crushed by their dad, you know, and by the pressure he put on them to become killers. And I think that really affected Donald, you know, really affected his relationship with alcohol, you know, because Freddie died of alcoholism. And, you know, there's real feeling and real trauma there. So if you dig a little bit under the surface, you find real emotions and real feelings, real human beings. At the same time, they are these two, like, relentless opportunists. You know, you can see it even in their own relationship. There's always been love and affection and real sort of loyalty. At the same time, as Roy at the end was, you know, sick and you know, was dying of AIDS and got disbarred, and Mr. Trump didn't really have a use for him. He was distancing himself from him, you know, because also, like, his image projection of, like, this macho image, the WWF guy or whatever in the 80s, you know, that was in contrast with like, having a, you know, a person with friends with AIDS, you know?
I wanted to go back to when Roy Cohen was his lawyer.
Right.
This is the early 70s when Donald is working with his father, Fred Trump, and the DOJ, the Department of Justice, sues them for racial discrimination, preventing people of color, primarily African Americans, from living in their housing developments in Queens. This clip begins with Roy Cohen speaking in court as Trump's defense attorney.
Objection. The Civil Rights Division did not file a lawsuit. Frankly, it compiled a 48-page press release, as far as I can tell. Now, the government has failed to spell out one single fact concerning alleged discriminatory practices against blacks by the Trumps. I motion to have this case dismissed on summary judgment.
Overruled. Counselor, continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Agent Green, what led you to believe that you were denied a lease at Trump Properties based on your race?
Well, not only did the newspaper advertise...
That's Walter, DOJ. He runs the show.
I saw three Caucasian couples approved before.
Objection, speculation.
Mr. Cohen.
How can you say for sure
Mr.
they were
Cohen,
Caucasian?
Please allow Agent Green to answer the question.
I've seen Puerto Ricans whiter than my tush ever.
That's a clip from The Apprentice, and it talks about this really, you know, horrific time as they're gaining their wealth, where they are preventing people of color from getting into their housing development. But talk about why this was so seminal for you, Roy Cohen representing Trump.
This was how they met. You know, DOJ had a really good case, actually, you know, and, you know, they marked, you know, black applicants with a C. That's actually from the case. So it was sort of colored. So this was sort of beyond reasonable doubt, you can say. And, you know, you can, again, you can look at reality in two ways. You can say, oh, the Trumps are racist, whatnot. You can also say a lot of people with the same kind of property and same kind of wealth, they just didn't want, you know, people of color or working class people or problems. And these were one of them, you know. Whichever way you look at it, it was problematic. DOJ had a good, really good case. And everyone was telling him, you know, you have to settle, you have to, you know, you have to give up. And then he sort of bumped into Roy. And Roy was the only person who said, no, we're going to, you know, countersue the government, of course. You know, we're going to go on attack, which they did, you know, on with him. And they settled out of court with not almost no even a slap on the wrist. You know, they got sort of do this sort of symbolic program and you know. And that's where I think Donald saw the power of Roy Cohen, and that's how their mentorship started, actually.
So I want to go back to what you were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, there have been many depictions of Roy Cohen. There have been many depictions, obviously, many more of Trump. But what this film does differently, and it does do it differently, is it makes them full characters, right? So you see them also in an empathetic light.
Right.
Do you think, and earlier you mentioned, that you're an outsider to the U.S. You've lived in Tehran, you've lived in Stockholm, and now you're settled in Copenhagen. Do you think your being an outsider is what enabled you to see them and their relationship in that light, in a way that they have not been represented in American depictions, let's say?
I certainly think it helped. Because I don't have the same, you know, I don't have a horse in this race. You know, I'm not Democrat, I'm not Republican. You know, I don't have an interest as such in the party politics. So I look at it as people and relationships in a relatively neutral way as such. Now, that doesn't mean, like, value-wise, I think everything's neutral and you know, there are good people on both sides. I don't believe that, you know? But as so far as the story goes and the characters, yes, I think I can investigate that and not be sort of, you know, intimidated by, you know, this side or other side, not to be, you know, not to be thinking so much of who would love this, who would hate this.
And you, as an Iranian filmmaker who's done such exceptional work in the past, your view growing up of the United States and what happened before and after the Iranian Revolution of 1979?
Right. I mean, we used to be an American colony, basically, you know, before 79. And that overnight,
with the U.S. supporting the Shah.
Yeah. And you know, not only supporting, but also culturally, economically, you know, it was much deeper than supporting just the Shah. And then after that, that changed overnight, you know, and we became sort of arch enemy of U.S. And growing up in that and growing up in that environment, you sort of have this sort of negative space that is inhibited by the great Satan, America, as the Islamic Republic was calling it. So you cannot help by being engaged or interested in U.S. politics, you know. But also, I think, as someone who grew up in the Middle East, you know, one thing that our experience, at least talking for myself, is there is not a huge difference between a Democratic president and a Republican president. There's not a, you know, we feel like the bombs are going to drop anyways. You know, we're going to get the short end of the stick anyways. And I think that sort of neutralizes this debate a little bit, you know, which is interesting because when you look at the sort of, you know, both the Democrats and Republicans, they try to create this inevitability of the other side being the villain, the other side would destroy this country and all that. But if you look at it, Fred Trump, his dad, Donald's dad, lifelong Democrat, Democratic donor, Roy Cohn, Democrat, Mr. Trump himself, a relatively, say, pro-abortion Democrat, gone to an anti-abortion Republican. What does that tell you about the U.S. political system?
And, of course, Roy Cohn was the ally of the Wisconsin Republican hate-monger Joe McCarthy, though he survives when Joe McCarthy ultimately takes on the Army and dies. But also in the execution of the Rosenbergs, that comes up a few times in your film. And for people who aren't familiar with what happened on June 21st, 1953, and Roy Cohn's role in that.
That's right, because he was instrumental in getting Rosenbergs executed. And, you know,
Ethel and Julius.
And there are different accounts, you know, as like how guilty they were and of their charges, espionage. But I think the accounts are sort of, people generally agree that Julius might have been guilty, but Ethel wasn't really, you know, guilty, or if she was, she wouldn't be guilty of execution, at least. That much is, I think, pretty well known and accepted. And I think Roy really pushed for them to be executed and to make a statement. And you know, basically manipulated the whole legal system and the judge and all that. And that's a really good example of what kind of person he was as a political operative. And again, this is a tradition, sort of, in a way, there is a, if you are interested in genealogy of American populist rights, there is a line going from Joseph McCarthy, Roy Cohn, Richard Nixon, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, Ronald Reagan, and over to Mr. Trump.
Acclaimed Iranian-Danish filmmaker Ali Abbasi directs The Apprentice, which opens today in theaters around the country and the world. The film stars Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump, Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohn, Strong's famous for starring in the Succession TV series, and Maria Bakalova, who plays Trump's first wife, Ivana. The film also deals with Ivana's allegations that Trump raped her. Trump's lawyers have sent Ali Abbasi a cease and desist order. Visit democracynow.org to see our interviews with Trump's niece, Mary, and nephew, Fred. Happy birthday to Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly one in four people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.